This Saturday, Florida International University hosts a graduate business degree open house where you can learn how an FIU MBA can give you the competitive advantage. This Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon, details and registration at FIU.com.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with colleague and co-host Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with Dr. Alex Baritzau. He's the editor of RealClearScience.com. He's the co-author of the book Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. He and co-author Hank Campbell say the left has just as much anti-science bias as those on the right. He joins us from Seattle via Skype. Welcome to you, Alex Baritzau.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So what are the main areas of...
Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. We had a little bit of a technical glitch there. Are you hearing me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay,
can you hear me now?
We're doing fine. So what are the main areas of contention as far as scientific bias on both left and right?
Well, on the right and... You know, it's sort of well known already, the anti-science biases of the right and their problems with evolution and with climate change and sometimes with embryonic stem cell research. However, what we feel has been less reported is the anti-science on the left. And for instance, the anti-vaccine movement started predominantly on the progressive left with people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., with people like Bill Maher, who actually still talks about that, and celebrities, Jenny McCarthy, Jim Carrey.
Oprah.
Yes. And so that's – and now, of course, the anti-vaccine movement has actually spread beyond the confines of the progressive left. Michelle Bachmann made a rather uninformed statement saying that it was associated with mental illness, mental retardation. But we do believe that that movement – started primarily on the left and still associated with that sort of way of thinking. So that's one topic that we talk about.
I thought that had pretty much been put to rest and debunked.
Well, I mean, it's been debunked in the scientific community for many years. In fact, I would go so far as to say is that the idea that vaccines causing autism never actually got any traction in the medical community. Nobody really believed that. However, there are still people who hold on to this today. I mean, you've seen that vaccine rates have fallen around the country, and I think they're starting to come back up again. But that, we think, is due largely to the misinformation that had been spread about vaccines and autism.
So why do you think the bias of the left is more dangerous than the bias on the right?
Well, precisely because vaccines are a matter of public health. So if someone... you know, refuses to believe in evolution, for instance, and wants to believe in a young Earth, that might not look very good, but it certainly won't kill anybody. Whereas if you don't take a vaccine, we have had now an outbreak of several different diseases, you know, pertussis, measles, which are completely preventable and are also deadly. And if you don't get those vaccines, people can die. And so I see that as an actual myth, a myth that has actual real-world consequences, whereas denial of evolution, you know, it doesn't look good, but no one dies from denying evolution.
Well, other than vaccines, what are the other biases of the left?
Well, we talk about in our book several different topics. For instance, the embrace of organic food, the rejection of genetically modified food, the partial embrace of some types of clean energy and the rejection of other types of clean energy. We also talk about the refusal to reform science education, and we talk about some of the policies of the Barack Obama administration, how they haven't been pro-science, and anti-animal research, which we also believe is also focused mostly on the left. So kind of a hodgepodge, a grab bag of various topics.
Go back to this business of trying to reform science education. How is that working? What do you see there?
Well, what my co-author and I think is that the problem is that politicians think that it's very good to get up and say, we need to hire more teachers. That's actually not the problem. George W. Bush promised to hire more teachers, I think like 20 or 30,000 more teachers. And then Barack Obama just recently said that he wanted to hire, I think, 100,000 teachers during his acceptance speech at the convention. The problem isn't hiring new science teachers, because what usually happens is that a lot of them quit after they're hired. The problem is teacher retention. And the reason that teacher retention is a problem is that new teachers often are laid off first. They often have to take teaching positions at schools that they don't necessarily like. And so we think that some of the best and brightest youngest teachers aren't staying in the profession, or they never enter it in the first place. And so if we want real science education reform, we need to pay teachers based on their merit. And I think that would also help science.
But why differentiate between science teachers versus history, English, or math?
Oh, no, we're not distinguishing them. I mean, because the book is about science, we talk about science teachers. But yeah, the same logic would apply to all teachers in general.
I want to go back to food. You talked about the left's bias against genetically modified food. Isn't there any scientific data that shows that they are harmful in any way?
Well, not really. I mean, most of the mainstream data shows that they're perfectly fine. Genetically modified food has been studied for at least 20 years now, and I would say probably even more, because the first food that went to market was in 1994. It was called the Flavor Saver tomato, and it's been around for a while. But it actually went off the market quickly after that. But other foods have been on the market for a while. I think the best, instead of getting into the scientific data, I think the best answer to that question is, well, who endorses genetically modified food? And the genetically modified food, the benefits of it have been essentially endorsed, or at least supported, by the American Medical Association, the National Academy of Sciences, the World Health Organization, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the several U.S. bureaucracies, the FDA, the EPA, the USDA. So these are the world's best and brightest medical doctors, scientists, and government regulators, and they have all approved of or given some type of tacit endorsement to genetic modification.
You mentioned the USDA approving of genetically modified foods, but they've also established an organic certification program that requires that all organic foods meet strict government standards. And you say the organic food industry is an unscientific scam. Why?
Okay, so a lot of organic farmers, it seems that to get organic certification, a lot of what they have to do is mostly paperwork. And there's not a lot of testing, not a lot of field testing. There's not a lot of surprise field testing. And so that's one area of concern that I think they need to tighten the regulations in the organic food industry. But not just in the organic food industry. I think overall our entire food system could use some tighter regulation. The reason that I think that organic food is kind of a scam is because of the way that it's marketed. It's marketed as a healthier, sustainable, more environmentally friendly lifestyle. And none of those statements are actually true. Nature News, which is the news arm of the journal Nature, recently ran a story about how the world could not be fed on organic food. It just simply cannot be done. We have to have conventional practices. A recent story came out, I believe, a week or a week and a half ago, which made huge news, made the BBC and the New York Times. I believe it was a Stanford study, which looked at 40 years worth of data, what they call a meta-analysis, which is analyzing data from multiple studies. And they found that organic food is not any healthier for you than conventionally grown food. And then in regard to pesticides, a paper in the Journal of Toxicology in 2011 said that the level of pesticide residues on conventional food is not unhealthy. And yes, it is true that organic food has fewer pesticides than conventional food, but conventional food is well below the safety threshold. So there's no concern about pesticides.
Actually, food guru and author Michael Pollan says there have been studies that shown that organic produce does have a higher nutritional value, and that the nutritional value of our fruits and vegetables have gone down in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, I'm not familiar with the studies that Michael Pollan had looked at, but the study that I'm citing it's not just another study. It's not one study out of many. It's a specific study called a meta-analysis. And what they do with a meta-analysis is they cull several different studies and they aggregate the data. And they aggregated data from 40 years worth of studies. And they concluded at Stanford, and this was also published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is an extremely reputable journal, they published that there was simply no nutritional difference between organic food and conventional food.
Dr. Alex Berezal, tell us a little more about you. You recently gained a degree in microbiology from the University of Washington. Tell us more a little bit about your studies and your areas of specialty.
So I grew up in Illinois originally, and I did my bachelor's degree in microbiology. And I spent a little bit of time in New York City at New York University doing some summer research one summer. I did Helicobacter pylori antibiotic resistance, and Helicobacter pylori is the bacteria which causes ulcers. So I did a little bit of that just for months in the summer. Got to live in Manhattan. And then I moved on to I spent some time in Madison, Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin doing a little bit of research there for a couple of months. And then I eventually moved out to Seattle to do the University of Washington, where I spent 6 years doing my PhD in microbiology. And my background is in gram-negative bacteria, which is bacteria that have two different membranes. And we studied the outer membrane and a particular molecule of the outer membrane called LPS and how changes in the structure of this molecule affect the human immune response.
We're speaking with author Dr. Alex Berezal. He has written Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. On today's Topical Currents, we need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, that's South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, Baptist Health, South Florida, Aflac Sastre Region, and the law firm of Kane & Associates. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to Wednesday's Topical Currents on WLRN. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Dr. Alex Berezal. He's the author of Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can email us, radio@WLRN.org, or you can call us at 1-800-743-9576. How do you feel about ideology and science is the question.
1-800-743-WLRN.
So, doctor, let me ask you, if you say it's not Democrats or Republicans who are the problem, what is the problem with reporting science accurately?
Well, we think that there is sort of a bias in how quickly the media is to jump on the anti-science beliefs of the conservatives, or particularly religious conservatives, while not simultaneously pointing out the same mistaken beliefs among the progressive left. For instance, Todd Akin obviously had some very uninformed comments to make about rape and pregnancy. And this was quickly, you know, not only just associated with him, but with the entire conservative movement as being out of touch with women's health and women's science and science of reproduction. However, when Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was an extremely highly profile person on the left, wrote a piece for Salon and Rolling Stone magazine about vaccines and autism, which had been thoroughly debunked by the time he had written it anyway, there was not this media backlash saying, hey, you know, these beliefs are coming from the progressive left. They didn't say that. And so we thought, you know, this really isn't very fair. It's not very fair to point out the political ideology of one side while ignoring the very obvious political demographic of the other side.
Of course, Kennedy Jr. wasn't 2 months away from a senatorial election.
That is true. However, like I said, he is a very high profile person.
Indeed.
as is Bill Maher and as is the California. Okay, here's another example. The California Democratic Party has recently endorsed Proposition 37. Now, Proposition 37 in California is the proposition to label genetically modified foods. Now, the American Medical Association has come out in opposition, and they said, according to them, that special labeling of genetically modified food is not necessary because they don't see a scientific justification for doing so, and they're afraid that it will confuse consumers into thinking essentially that genetically modified foods are dangerous. So they said that labeling of genetically modified foods is not necessary, and the California Democratic Party endorsed the opposite position. They took the position in direct opposition to America's Best Doctors. That didn't even make the news. My co-author and I think are a little bit frustrated by what we see as a hesitancy to attack or to criticize people on the left for holding anti-science beliefs.
Why is there such distrust of new technology such as genetically modified mosquito control? We have a little bit of that going in our backyard.
Yeah, I know.
Here in Key West concerning dengue fever.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. You know, I think that it has to do with not understanding something breeds fear, and genetics is very complicated. You know, I have my PhD in microbiology, and I'm still learning some things about genetics. I have much to learn about genetics, actually. And I think that when people who are not scientifically trained hear about these technologies, I think it stimulates a fear response naturally. We're afraid of things that we don't really understand. And biotechnology is just one of those things where you're combining the latest technology with biology. And I think that conjures up, you know, thoughts of Frankenstein and things that people don't necessarily want to think about. And I think that that's kind of the basis of the fear, is just not understanding the technology.
We have an emailer. I thought I read, this is Mary in Miami. I thought I read some time ago that one of the GMO crops, maybe corn, had an effect on monarch butterflies. Did that not turn out to be true?
So they showed that in the laboratory, if they were kind of forced to eat this pollen, they don't do very well. But out in the field, I don't believe that panned out. And the reason is because when they're out in the field, they have other things they can eat. And if I remember correctly, I don't think that study panned out once they did field trials.
Okay.
And we have a caller here. If you'd like to join in, that number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. This is Frank in Parkland. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I was calling to talk to a microbiologist. This is great. When I think of GMO, when I hear GMO, I think of mad cow's disease. Now, I know, just follow this if you can. Mad cow's disease was, a prion, which is a malformed protein, which caused other normal proteins to flip and cause brain diseases, a brain disease that was eventually very harmful, kills people. And I find that GMO, genetically modified organisms, are similar in the sense where you're doing something unnatural. You're taking genes from fish and putting them in tomatoes. This isn't something that you could say that Mendel did in his garden, you know, where he could stuck a fish in the ground and a tomato picked up the gene. You're actually doing something that's very, to me, unnatural, and trying to put it into the food chain. And I think that there's an amount of hubris where you think that you can take a protein from a fish and stick it in a tomato, and you really don't know what will happen to that protein or how it will behave, because you shoot it in there. You don't, like, methodically, surgically set it in.
That's not true. When you do a genetic modification, they can precisely locate in the genome, if they want to. They can pretty much dictate where that gene goes if they try hard enough. It's not just shot in willy-nilly.
That done? Can you explain it a little bit for me?
Well, I mean, it basically involves... Now, in plants, you're right. They can do that in plants where they kind of shoot it in the genome, they cross their fingers, and they kind of hope it goes in the right spot. But you can target genes by recombination. So what that means is if you take a gene, this is kind of complicated genetics, but basically is if you take a DNA sequence that is very similar to the DNA sequence in which you want to insert a gene, you can place a gene of interest essentially in between you can kind of have this
how is it placed exactly? I mean, does it diffuse into solution and somehow just kind of put itself into place, or is it shot
It actually physically inserts into the genome, and so every cell of the let's say that you're genetically modifying a fish with a gene that makes it glow green, for instance. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but we could do that if we wanted to. You could say, okay, we're going to take this gene that caused it to glow green, and we're going to modify the ends of the gene so that these ends look like a sequence inside the fish genome. And then when you put that into the cells, the cell's machinery will uptake that on its own and insert it into the genome. And that's one of the – because of the cell's internal machinery with dealing with its own DNA, we take advantage of that when you insert a gene. No, I want to go back to your comment about mad cow disease. So it's not true that we don't know what's going to happen if you take a fish gene and put it into a strawberry plant. The reason we know that it's safe is because you can eat fish. We've been eating fish for, hundreds of thousands of years, and we're fine. We've been eating strawberries for hundreds of thousands of years, and we're fine. And so the FDA uses this idea called substantial equivalence, which is if it's natural and it's not changing the nutritional quality, and there's no reason to believe that this is harmful, then it's considered substantially equivalent to the normal, regular, unmodified food. And so if you take a strawberry gene and put it into a fish, there's no reason to believe that's going to cause any problems, because we've been eating strawberries and we've been eating fish, and neither of them cause any problems.
I have an emailer here, Doctor. It's Jose. He is a Florida resident attending school at Georgia Tech. I have no objection to the content of what he presented, only with the statement he made about GMOs, about who endorses them, as opposed to looking at the science. As an engineering student and a scientist in training, I find that statement to be alarming, since endorsement does not equate to solid, objective evidence of the effectiveness or benefit of a product or process. And we depend on such agencies to inform the public, since not all citizens can know the latest science. But the science should not be glossed over. If you could please ask your guest about how individuals may research science topics on their own.
Absolutely. I'm not sure what's alarming about it. About my comment, the topic is extremely complicated, as I demonstrated with the last conversation. So getting into the genetic mechanisms of how GMOs operate, I think, is a very detailed and long conversation, probably outside the scope of what we're doing here, which is why I relied on the endorsements instead, because I just wanted to show that the major American scientific organizations do support genetic modification. But what question was it again that he wants me to address specifically?
His question, let me get back to it. He wants to know how individuals can research science topics on their own.
And that's a great question. And I think that if you want to become more well-versed in this area, you need to pay attention to the major science journals and the reviews and the information that comes out of those. So in my opinion, reviews from Nature, from PNAS, that's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the Journal Science, the Journal of the American Medical Association, these are all fantastic sources. And, the content of those journals is extremely advanced, but you can understand usually the abstract. The abstract kind of boils things down to here are a few bullet points that you can take away from this paper. And I think that if people read more of those, they would get a better sense of where the scientific community stands on these issues.
The book speaks about the death of science journalism. Could you expound on that?
Yeah. So we talked about how when journalists decide to take on certain causes, that's not good either for journalism or for the cause itself. And my co-author came up with this analogy, and I think that it's really great. He said that sports journalists don't feel the need to defend baseball, for instance. They feel the need to report the ups and downs and the scandals and, you know, the nitty-gritty of what happens during the season and the drama. But that's not how science journalists treat science. They treat science more as something that needs to be defended, something that needs to be promoted. And in that way, that's not really what a journalist's job is. A journalist's job is to get down to the bottom of an issue, to nitpick, to fight with scientists, to ask awkward questions. That's the job of a journalist. You're not supposed to just take a press release and you know, churn it out as gospel truth. That's not the job of a journalist.
But didn't that go on for decades with the tobacco industry hiring a very small minority of scientists to debunk the harms of smoking?
And that's not a good thing, right? So what our case is basically is that that's not a good way to handle journalism. And another thing that we talk about, of course, is our belief that journalists are also more likely to criticize conservatives while ignoring the political left and their anti-science beliefs. And so what we're essentially calling for is for more balance in political science reporting. Or I'm sorry, in the intersection of science and politics, more balance in being able to call out both sides of the political spectrum equally when they ignore what science teaches us.
Well, science ignores politics and religion, it's true, but can science always be trusted? Aren't there often inherent conflicts of interest?
There can be conflicts of interest, but what I find particularly enjoyable about the scientific method is that fraud and misinformation is usually rooted out. For instance, the vaccine controversy with autism, Dr. Andrew Wakefield was found eventually, I believe 13 years after he published his original study showing a link between vaccines and autism, that it was fraudulent. Now, the scientific process takes a long time. Sometimes it takes 10, 20 years to root out fraud. But usually what happens is someone else will try to replicate the work or will try to build upon the work, and then they are not able to. They're not able to actually redo what this previous scientist had done. And then that starts to set up a red flag that either there was a mistake or there was something more nefarious going on. Now, usually it's a mistake. Usually it's not fraud. But that's the self-correcting nature of the scientific method and the scientific publication process, is that you have this constant checking and rechecking and double-checking and triple-checking. And that's why it's such a great instrument for discerning secular truth.
We're speaking with Dr. Alex Barazow. He's the author, co-author of Science Left Behind, Feel Good Fallacies, The Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. We have an emailer, Dr. Nicholas. He says, would the author like to tell us his point of view regarding the wisdom of having former influential employees of major corporations selling genetically modified products taking positions at the head of the FDA and DOA? Perhaps he has not seen the documentary Genetic Roulette by Jeffrey Smith. The facts depicted in this documentary go counter to what he's telling us today.
I'm not sure how what I'm saying is going counter what your emailer said. I'm telling you about the science and how scientific organizations such as the American Medical Association and the National Academy of Sciences also support genetically modified food, including the United Nations. Now, I don't think that those organizations are corrupted by former CEOs of Monsanto. But what your emailer is bringing up actually is a business ethics issue. It's not a scientific issue. And we have to learn to separate those two. The science of genetic modification is solid. Now, if you want to nitpick about business ethics or about government revolving door ethics, that is a completely and separate issue. And it's not one that I'm particularly well versed in, because I'm a scientist and I don't really deal with, you know, business dealings and legal matters and things like that. That's not my expertise. But we do need to keep in mind that those are two separate issues. Science and business ethics are two completely different things.
Let's take a call or two. This is Leo. Leo, turn down your radio, please.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Leo in Miami, go ahead.
Yeah, Yes. I'm driving, and unfortunately, I couldn't listen to the previous email, but I think it has to do with what I'm going to say, and I couldn't listen to the answer either, unfortunately. I'm sorry about that. The first point I want to make is that as an individual, I appreciate the research that the scientists and doctors do, but I think it's very sad when it's politicized, no matter if it's left or right. And someone who has invested so much time into researching information, where is the heart? More than the left and right and whoever's behind paying for those studies. And I guess also influencing the answer of those studies could be Harvard or Stanford. Where is the heart and the soul of all this, where you have people from Monsanto controlling the FDA or influencing the political system, and the amount, the billions of dollars that are going to these researches and benefiting products that are coming out of it, feeding our people, and then the consequences of cancer and other diseases, and I mean everything is linked. Where is the soul besides the fact of who's influencing the?
Let Mr. Berizzo address that, Leo. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So if I understand correctly, and if you can help me, his question is, what is the soul of the genetic modification movement? Like, where is the science base? Is that the question he was asking?
I think he's saying instead of people politicizing what should be objective scientific facts and figures, because we're dealing with lives here, and I think that's what he wants to keep the politics out of science.
Yeah, and that's, of course, the eternal struggle. That's kind of the $64,000 question. How do you keep politics out of science? And that's hard to do because science itself will put forward certain conclusions. Certain scientific conclusions may lend themselves towards certain policy stances and may have certain policy implications. And therefore, it becomes very difficult to separate science from science policy. But what people need to keep in mind is that science policy is more than just science, right? Scientists aren't politicians. They're not bureaucrats. And so when we make a science policy decision, we also have to consult with bureaucrats, with government regulators, with economists, and there's all sorts of other influences that go into making a science policy decision. Unfortunately, we can't make all of our decisions based 100% on science.
Dr. Berizzo, you have a whole chapter on PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, in your book. You say that their behavior borders on crimes against humanity. Do you think that PETA has accomplished anything worthwhile?
Well, yes and no. I think the idea that we should be nice to animals is clearly an idea that needs to be accepted by all of society. However, their opposition to animal research is devastating. The chapter we talk about talks – we mentioned PETA obviously because they're the highest profile animal rights organization. But we're talking about also animal rights groups
right. In
general. Let me give you a story. When I was at the University of Washington, we would get emails telling us – usually once a year, the animal rights activists were in the neighborhood. And I don't believe they were PETA, but we were told to be very careful. And the reason is because they have certain animal rights extremists have a tendency to assault scientists, either verbally or physically, or threaten them or intimidate them. And that's the kind of climate in under which I was sort of introduced to this movement, okay? It was from the scientific perspective and getting emails from the University of Washington warning us when they were in the neighborhood or possibly in the neighborhood. And so – and then if you look at the message that they're putting out there, that animal research is evil or that it's essentially torture, it is not possible for us as a society to study cancer, to study Alzheimer's disease, to study any infectious disease. Essentially, nothing we can do medically everything we have learned medically has ultimately been rooted in animal research. And so to deny that, to try to turn that away, is essentially trying to block all of medical progress as we know it.
But aren't there a great many flaws in animal research and testing, the way it's conducted?
Well, there are. Animal research isn't perfect, right? So you cannot do a one-to-one model, for instance, like if you do a study in a ferret on for influenza, you don't know for certain that what you learn in the ferret is going to translate to humans. But we don't have any other options, right? We don't have computer models, and we don't know if we could even trust computer models if we had them.
Right.
And so you have to use animals because it's the next best thing. We can't go around infecting humans with these diseases and seeing what's going to happen. That would be outrageous and horribly unethical. And so the next best option is to use animals. But opposition to this is essentially blocking the only tool we have to do medical research.
But in past decades, there were some real horror stories of animal testing. Don't you think that the pressure put on by animal activists have made the scientific community, more humane?
Maybe. I don't really know.
Maybe?
But I would say maybe, because the animal rights abuses or animal abuses in the laboratory are extremely rare. They're extremely rare. And the reason that they make big news is because they're rare. This is not a normal, regular thing. The idea that scientists are out abusing animals is simply not true. It doesn't line up with reality. And so did PETA reduce this? Maybe. Scientists in general don't abuse or torture animals. So I don't know if they've accomplished anything. One thing that I do find a little upsetting is that back in, I would say, maybe 30, 40 years ago, polls showed that the overwhelming number of Americans supported animal research. It was something like 80, 90%. It was a very high number. Today, that number is around 50%. And so I attribute that drop to groups like PETA, which are putting out misinformation about the benefits of animal research.
Just sticking with animals for just another moment, you contend that, quote, the dumbest person is still a genius compared to the smartest chimpanzee, end quote. Just want to know what the basis is for that statement.
We were talking about the differences between humans and animals.
Right.
And so we were talking about there were several characteristics, and I can't think of them off the top of my head with that chapter, but about what is referred to as humaniqueness, the human uniqueness. And so we were talking about how it is ethical to research with animals because humans are kind of in a different league. We're kind of in a different playing field.
Talking about primates, though, now, because we were talking about that quote was about a chimpanzee.
Yes. And so the point that we were making is that humans are kind of in a different playing, different ballpark, right? Intellectually, socially, morally. And so we find that it is justifiable to research with animals as long as humans are kind of at the top of the food chain, so to speak.
We are speaking with Dr. Alex Berezau. He's the editor of RealClearScience.com. You might want to check out that website. He's also the co-author of Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies, and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. We're going to take another short break and be back with more.
We'll be back to Tropical Currents in just a moment here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys.
The Alliance Theater Lab presents Home Sweet Funeral Home, 8 funny 10-minute brand new works by local playwrights set in a funeral home. Now running through September 23rd, 8 p.m. Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, and 2 p.m. on Sundays. Performances are at the Pelican Theater at Barry University, 11300 Northeast 2nd Avenue, Miami Shores. Reservations at 305-259-0418 or thealliancetheaterlab.com. Join us for Thursday's Topical Currents for the popular Restaurant Roundabout with chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. We'll have critics based in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade. And, of course, take your calls about favorite dining spots. Perhaps there's a new cafe that hits the mark, a favorite steakhouse, diner, or sushi place. Give Us the Word, Thursday at 1 o'clock.
And thanks so much for joining us for today's Topical Currents on WLRN. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Dr. Alex Barrazau. He's the co-author of the book Science Left Behind, Feel Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. And he's joining us via Skype from Seattle. Doctor, I have an emailer from Carol, an email from Carol in Coconut Grove. Your guest's comparison of Robert Kennedy Jr.'s comments about vaccines to Todd Akin's comments about rape is ridiculous. There's still some debate about the former, despite the author's claims that science has debunked it, whereas the latter is completely inaccurate. Any comment?
Yeah, the emailer is simply incorrect. There is no debate in the medical community about vaccines and autism. There is also, of course, no debate about whether or not rape causes pregnancy. Of course it does. But the emailer is misinformed. There is no debate in the medical community about whether or not vaccines cause autism. They do not.
But I think what she's talking about is comparing them.
That the liberal side were quick to get on Akin, but that they didn't do the same with the comments of Kennedy Jr. And she's saying that they're completely different. They're apples and oranges as far as issues and their severity.
Well, why are they apples and oranges?
Well, the violation of a human being in rape versus somebody questioning whether scientific theory is correct.
Okay, so I'm looking at it from a scientific information point of view.
Well, I'm sorry. I want to hear you. I don't want to be pontificating myself. So
right. So the idea that. Yes, violating a woman is a horrible thing, but if I understand correctly, that's not what she was referring to. She was referring to the scientific validity of the knowledge at the time. And yes, obviously rape causes pregnancy, and what Todd Akin said was just preposterous and insensitive and stupid. But the idea that vaccines causes autism is treated the same way in the medical community. If you were to go into a hospital or to a biology lab and make the claim that vaccines causes autism, they would think that's ridiculous and stupid as well. There is no evidence that this is the case, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. should have known this in 2005. There was a 2002 study out of Denmark which looked at 500,000 people, and they concluded that there was absolutely no link between vaccines, particularly the MMR vaccine, and autism. And that was 4 years after the claim made in 1998 by Andrew Wakefield. So the idea that this is still debated is simply not true. It might be debated on political talk shows, but it's not debated in the medical community.
Tell me, let's shift scientific gears a little bit, Dr. Barrazau. How about the American Space Program? Is its future politicized also?
You know, a little bit. I think all science funding issues are politicized, precisely because it involves politicians, and they all want to try to fight for who is more pro-science, and so they kind of fight over that kind of they want to kind of look good to their constituents and say, hey, we brought home some science funding. So yeah, I think that the future of space is going to be a politicized thing. The future of Americans in space is probably going to be a politicized issue. But I don't think it has to be. I think that most Americans want to see us in space. I think the debate really will be, should this be a private sector thing or a public sector thing? And I don't think there's really an easy answer to this question. I think probably a mix of both is what we need to do.
And let's take another listener call or two. This is a Boca Raton caller, Milt. Hi there.
Hi, Jeff. I'd like to make a statement regarding the attitude and the content of what Alex is making in his claims. First of all, he's representing only the conservative press, and he does become a conservative scientist in doing that. The concern that he's, as I wrote it down, is that the food additives and the global agribusiness have to have more influence over press, because they can't make the progress that they're making around the world in adding things to food and adding things to products, not just food but products, which is unhealthy, and science research is finding that we're finding DDT and plastics in mother's milk and in bloodstreams of children today. We're finding things that we put in plastics to go into furniture or upholstery 40 years ago, and it's in mother's milk and it's in children's blood, and we're not sure where it's coming from because nobody's doing the research to pin down what factory here. But the fact is that around the world, the only people controlling global food and manufacturing are American manufacturers and European manufacturers, and they're unregulated in the secondary influence of things that they add, and they're unregulated because the conservatives don't want regulation.
Let Dr. Berezow comment on that.
I'll get off the line.
Well, we certainly thank you for your call. Dr.
Well, it's certainly not true that additives aren't regulated. That any additive, any food additive, actually, I believe that might be a legal term, actually, is regulated by the FDA. They look at that. And so, you know, so if we were to believe that the FDA is controlled by, you know, biotech companies and agricultural companies, well, then I can't really comment on that because I don't know if that's true or not. But the FDA does regulate food additives, and they do look at things for safety. As for the chemicals that are in our bloodstream and in our mother's milk, I'm assuming he's referring to BPA. A major scientific review published last year from Europe, but I can't remember what journal it was published in, was, I believe, a meta-analysis. And they looked at – and again, a meta-analysis is not just one study. They cull multiple studies and they statistically analyze the data. And they showed that there was simply no link between BPA and any ill health effects. There was no reason for concern.
Doctor, I'm getting so many emails. I don't have time to read them all, but they're all saying that the effects of GMOs have not been found to be unharmful.
Well, that sets rather a difficult standard for science to meet, right? So when you say that prove to me that something is safe, that's asking science to do something that it can't actually do. Science can certainly prove that something is unsafe. You know, we can show that cigarettes are bad for you. We can show that causes cancer. But let's turn that around. Prove to me that ketchup is safe. Well, we can't actually prove that. Maybe we'll find out there's some disease that we've all been slowly accumulating, you know, 100 years from now because of ketchup. You can't ask a question of science like that. Prove to me that this is safe. It's simply a bar that's too high. Science can't answer that. We can show something is unsafe. We can prove that. But the flip side is just not something that science is going to be able to answer.
Well, when we mentioned that documentary earlier, did you see that documentary? Because evidently it does highlight the serious health dangers of genetically modified food. I don't remember the name of it now.
I have not seen that documentary.
Okay.
But once again, if that's true, and first of all, there are no known mechanisms for why genetically modified food would be causing any health problems because, like I said, most of the genetic modification, what they're doing is they're taking a gene from one plant or from one organism that we already know is safe, and we're taking a gene out of that and putting it into another organism that we also know is safe. So, for instance, if you were to, you know, I'm just making this up, but if you wanted to take the gene from strawberries, which makes it red, and put that into a fish so that the fish would turn red, there's no reason to believe that that would cause any ill health effects. The reason is because we know strawberries are healthy, they're fine for us to eat, and fish are healthy, those are fine for us to eat, and so therefore there's no known biological mechanism by which that sort of manipulation would be dangerous. And like I said, if it is true that if it were true that GMOs pose this sort of a health risk, I find it very hard to believe that the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and the America's best science organizations would all endorse that.
Well, it's certainly been an interesting hour. We hope you've enjoyed it. I want to apologize for those callers. We couldn't get on the air. We did our best. We've been visiting with Dr. Alex Berezow. He's the editor of RealClearScience.com. I think you can get a little more idea of his views there. He's also the co-author of Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies, and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. Thank you very much, Dr. Alex Berezow.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Doctor.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. You can follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Find author and book links, such as today's. We also have staff photos and discussion. Also, free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program, our popular restaurant roundabout with Linda Gassenheimer and restaurant critics. We'll take calls about your favorite eateries and give advice about new ones and old favorites. Wine columnist Fred Tasker on hand as well. And to the calendar, on this day in 1876, 136 years ago, Melville Bissell of Grand Rapids, Michigan, patents the carpet sweeper, forerunner of the vacuum cleaner. After his death, wife Anna became the first female U.S. CEO. And on this day, 1952, 60 years ago, the U.S. refuses to allow filmmaker Charlie Chaplin to re-enter the country from England because of his, quote, moral values and subversive character. One more while Daddy's sleeping and Mama ain't around. On this day in 1960, 52 years ago, Chubby Checker's version of The Twist enters the U.S. chart and soars to number one. Chubby Checker's stage name is a play on Fats Domino. We leave with a thought from Charlie Chaplin. I remain just one thing, and one thing only, and that is a clown. It places me on a far higher plane than any politician. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thanks for being with us.